Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is. I'm Ana Mateo in Washington. On today's program, we hear how the structured soccer culture in the U.S. may be different from soccer cultures around the world. But first, we hear about a recent college graduate who is truly a living example of the expression, "It's never too late to learn." Many schools across the United States hold graduation ceremonies this time of year. College and university graduations are especially happy celebrations. With degrees in hand, graduates start a new and important part of their lives. This is especially true for Jerry Reed. He graduated this year from the University of Virginia in Charlottesville with a bachelor's degree. Wearing a UVA t-shirt, backpack, and a boyish smile, he looks like most of the students on campus, except for his gray hair. You see, Jerry Reed is 70 years old. He says he did not want just a degree. He says he wanted to have the full college experience he did not have as a younger man. So Mr. Reed joined the WHO crew, a group that cheers loudly for the school at sports events.
Wahoo! Wahoo!
He also joined a fraternity, a men's group on campus. He went to bars and sang drinking songs along with many other students. Mr. Reed is popular on campus. His age does not seem to make any difference at all. About a half century ago, in his 20s, Mr. Reed was not in school. Instead, he was racing cars and chasing girls. But he says his friend Bill invited him to UVA parties.
Bill Sturman just told me what a screw-up I was, that there was no way I'd ever make anything out of my life unless I came up here and went to school with him.
That was in 1963. Jerry Reed says it took him 48 years to take that advice. In 2011, he entered college. UVA professor Luke Wright says Mr. Reed influenced students. Professor Wright says he opened the minds of the young adults. The teacher says Mr. Reed showed them that life does not end at 40. Quite the opposite. The 70-year-old college graduate believes that getting older can be the beginning of a dream. He advises others that it is never too late to try to make the life you have always wanted.
Remember that path that you left waits for you. It's there. It's yours. All you got to do is get out of your own way and get back to it. And that's exactly what I did.
I'm Ana Mateo. You are listening to As It Is. We just heard a story about a man who reached his goal of going to college at the age of 70. Now we hear about a different kind of goal, soccer goals. We find out how soccer culture in the U.S. is different from soccer cultures around the world. Mario Ritter brings us that story.
For many around the world, playing soccer is as natural as breathing. The fact that the game is so pure is part of its beauty. All you need is a ball. And even that does not stop a child who wants to play. They will just make one. Soccer's free spirit is captured in a new children's book called Goal. The book's colorful photographs by Caio Villela show soccer at its simplest and most spontaneous, or unplanned. All the photographs share two things in common: a soccer ball and big smiles of children. Artur Atunis Coimbra, better known as Zico, is now a soccer coach. But in the late 1970s and early 80s, he was one of the world's top soccer players. In the introduction to Goal, Zico says the book reminds him of playing soccer as a child, and how the spontaneous games are where he really learned to play.
The spontaneous game means everything for a soccer player. That's where you polish your skills. You learn to find vacant spaces in the ground. You get to find your place in the game, and finally, you're taught how to score the most amazing goals. We played with rubber balls, plastic ones, with balls made of socks.
Zico says that he believes this is what true soccer is all about: pure, spontaneous play. Yet that is very different from mainstream soccer culture in the United States. Soccer, for most children in the U.S., is a planned activity for the whole family. U.S. kids usually join a soccer league organized by parents or a school. There are fees to pay and soccer uniforms to buy. They have planned practice times, and a parent, often a mother, takes kids to their practices and games. Even snacks and drinks are organized by a parent volunteer, sometimes called a soccer mom. Allison Merton is a soccer mom in Washington, D.C. She has been the manager of her 7-year-old daughter's soccer team for the past 3 years. She says it is a lot of work.
I've been the team manager for a couple of seasons, and I'm now going to hand that off to someone else because it's a lot of work to organize and get everybody to the games and the practices and coordinate everyone's schedules and make sure everybody knows when their snack day and drink day is, and organizing the end of the year party and the coach's gift and, you know, the detail. There's a lot of details and a lot of work that goes into just planning soccer for little kids.
All this planning and scheduling might be killing the free spirit of soccer, but Allison Merton says she feels structured play is normal in the U.S. today. It is unclear if too much organization hurts the true spirit of soccer in the U.S. That probably does not concern parents. What does concern parents is that their kids have the opportunity to play outdoors and to play on a team, and they will take these experiences any way they can get them. This story was written by Anna Mateo. I'm Mario Ritter.
Thanks, Mario. Our story on the 70-year-old graduate was written by Carolyn Prasuti. For more Learning English programs, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and iTunes. And join us again tomorrow for another As It Is.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English,
This is In the News. President Barack Obama has announced a plan to help the Iraqi government stop unrest in the country. His plan is aimed at increasing intelligence gathering and improving security in Iraq. It also includes sending up to 300 United States military advisors to support the government against Islamic militants. The president spoke to reporters at the White House on Thursday. He said, "The plan does not involve sending U.S. combat forces to Iraq."
American combat troops are not going to be fighting in Iraq again. We do not have the ability to simply solve this problem by sending in tens of thousands of troops and committing the kinds of blood and treasure that has already been expended in Iraq. Ultimately, this is something that is going to have to be solved by the Iraqis.
Just 2.5 years ago, the president ordered the last U.S. ground troops in the Iraq War to leave the country. The order followed 8 years of fighting. Recently, Mr. Obama has been considering what to do in Iraq because of Sunni Muslim militants. Militant fighters have taken control of major Iraqi cities and territory. A group called the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant is leading the offensive. In his speech, Mr. Obama made an appeal to Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He urged Mr. Maliki, a Shiite, to rise above religious differences and make the government more inclusive.
Iraqi leaders must rise above their differences and come together around a political plan for Iraq's future. Shia, Sunni, Kurds, all Iraqis must have confidence that they can advance their interests and aspirations through the political process rather than through violence.
On Wednesday, U.S. Vice President Joseph Biden spoke with Mr. Maliki by telephone. Mr. Biden urged him to govern in what he called an inclusive manner, promote stability and unity among Iraq's population, and address the legitimate needs of Iraq's diverse communities. An American official told VOA the U.S. military has been ready to direct with several plans of action. The military has held back because of Iraq's political situation. Sheikh Nasser bin Hamad al-Khalifa is a former Qatari ambassador to the United Nations and to the U.S. The Sheikh offered his opinion on the political situation. He said, "Instead of really opening up Iraq and making it a model for the region, Maliki became beholden to the Iranian strategic goals in the region, i.e. to dominate the whole Middle East and the Gulf, and he created a sectarian state." On Friday, Iraqi troops continued fighting Islamic militants over control of a major oil refinery. Since Tuesday, the two sides have fought more than 200 kilometers north of Baghdad for control of the Beji refinery. As of late Thursday, each side held part of the factory. In another development, the U.S. State Department confirmed that the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant has taken control of a chemical weapons center. A State Department official said, "The U.S. is concerned about the seizure of any site by the ISIL." She added that the center likely does not contain chemical weapons of military value. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Now, the VOA Special English Program, American Stories. Our story today is called The Open Boat. It was written by Stephen Crane and is based on what really happened to him in 1896. Crane was traveling from the United States to Cuba as a newspaper reporter. One night, his ship hit a sandbar. It sank in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Florida. Most of the people on board got into lifeboats. Crane was among the last to leave. There were three others with him, the ship's captain, the cook, and a sailor. These four men climbed into the only remaining lifeboat. The boat was so small that no one believed it could stay afloat for very long. None of the four men thought he would ever reach the shore. But the men fought the rough seas bravely with all their strength. Would they finally reach land? Here is Shep O'Neill with the first part of the story.
The small lifeboat bounced from wave to wave in the rough seas of the Atlantic. The four men in the boat could not see the sky. The waves rose too high. The waves, with their white tops, pushed at the open boat with angry violence. Every man thought each wave would be his last. Surely the boat would sink, and he would drown. The man thought that most adults would need a bathtub larger than the boat they were sailing. The waves were huge, and each created a problem in guiding the direction of the boat. For 2 days since the ship sank, the four men had been struggling to reach land. But there was no land to be seen. All the men saw were violent waves, which rose and came fiercely down on them. The men sat in the boat, wondering if there was any hope for them. The ship's cook sat in the bottom of the boat. He kept looking at the 15 centimeters which separated him from the ocean. The boat had only 2 wooden oars. They were so thin, it seemed as if they would break against the waves. The sailor, named Billy, directed the boat's movement with 1 of the oars. The newspaper reporter pulled the 2nd oar. He wondered why he was there in the boat. The 4th man was the captain of the ship that had sunk. He lay in the front of the small boat. His arm and leg were hurt when the ship sank. The captain's face was sad. He had lost his ship and many of his sailors. But he looked carefully ahead, and he told Billy when to turn the boat. "Keep her a little more south, Billy," he said. "A little more south, sir," the sailor repeated. Sitting in the boat was like sitting on a wild horse. As each wave came, the boat rose and fell, like a horse starting toward a fence too high to jump. The problem was that after successfully floating over 1 wave, you find that there is another one behind it, just as strong and ready to flood your boat. As each wall of water came in, it hid everything else that the men could see. The waves came in silence. Only their white tops made threatening noises. In the weak light, the faces of the men must have looked gray. Their eyes must have shone in strange ways as they looked out at the sea. The sun rose slowly into the sky. The men knew it was the middle of the day because the color of the sea changed from slate gray to emerald green with gold lights, and the white foam on the waves looked like falling snow. As the lifeboat bounced from the top of each wave, the wind tore through the hair of the men. As the boat dropped down again, the water fell just past them. The top of each wave was a hill from which the men could see, for a brief period, a wide area of shining sea. The cook said the men were lucky because the wind was blowing toward the shore. If it started blowing the other way, they would never reach land. The reporter and the sailor agreed, but the captain laughed in a way that expressed humor and tragedy all in one. He asked, "Do you think we've got much of a chance now, boys?" This made the others stop talking. To express any hope at this time, they felt to be childish and stupid. But they also did not want to suggest there was no hope, so they were silent. "Oh, well," said the captain, "we'll get ashore all right." But there was something in his voice that made them think, as the sailor said, "Yes, if this wind holds." Seagulls flew near and far. Sometimes the birds sat down on the sea in groups near brown seaweed that rolled on the waves. The anger of the sea was no more to them than it was to a group of chickens 1,000 miles away on land. Often the seagulls came very close and stared at the men with black bead-like eyes. The man shouted angrily at them, telling them to be gone. The sailor and the reporter kept rowing with the thin wooden oars. Sometimes they sat together, each using an oar. Sometimes one would pull on both oars while the other rested. Brown pieces of seaweed appeared from time to time. They were like islands. Bits of earth that did not move. They showed the men in the boat that it was slowly making progress toward land. Passed. Then, as the boat was carried to the top of a great wave, the captain looked across the water. He said that he saw the lighthouse at Mosquito Inlet. The cook also said he saw it. The reporter searched the western sky. "See it?" said the captain. "No," said the reporter slowly. "I don't see anything." "Look again," said the captain. He pointed. "It's exactly in that direction." This time, the reporter saw a small thing on the edge of the moving horizon. It was exactly like the point of a pin. "Think we'll make it, Captain?" he asked. "If this wind holds and the boat doesn't flood, we can't do much else," said the captain. It would be difficult to describe the brotherhood of men that was here established on the sea. Each man felt it warmed him. They were a captain, a sailor, a cook, and a reporter. And they were friends. The reporter knew even at the time that this friendship was the best experience of his life. All obeyed the captain. He was a good leader. He always spoke in a low voice and calmly. "I wish we had a sail," he said, "to give you two boys a chance to rest." So they used his coat and one of the oars to make a sail, and the boat moved much more quickly. The lighthouse had been slowly growing larger. At last, from the top of each wave, the men in the boat could see land. Slowly, the land seemed to rise from the sea. Soon, the men could see two lines, one black and one white. They knew that the black line was formed by trees, and the white line was the sand. At last, the captain saw a house on the shore, and the lighthouse became even larger. "The keeper of the lighthouse should be able to see us now," said the captain. "He'll notify the life-saving people." Slowly and beautifully, the land rose from the sea. The wind came again. Finally, the men heard a new sound, the sound of waves breaking and crashing on the shore. "We'll never be able to make the lighthouse now," said the captain. "Swing her head a little more north, Billy."
"A little more north, sir," said the sailor.
The men watched the shore grow larger. They became hopeful. In an hour, perhaps, they would be on land. The men struggled to keep the boat from turning over. They were used to balancing in the boat. Now they rode this wild horse of a boat like circus men. The water poured over them. The reporter thought he was now wet to the skin, but he felt in the top pocket of his coat and found 8 cigars. 4 were wet, but 4 were still dry. One of the men found some dry matches. Each man lit a cigar. The 4 men sailed in their boat with the belief of a rescue shining in their eyes. They smoked their big cigars and took a drink of water.
You have been listening to the first part of the American short story, The Open Boat, by Stephen Crane. This program was adapted for Special English by Shelley Gollist and produced by LaJuan Davis. Your storyteller was Shep O'Neill. Join us again next week when we tell you the second and last part of the story. You can read and listen to other American stories on our website, voaspecialenglish.com. I'm Barbara Klein.